Hello, welcome to Therapy Talks. I'm Chris Place and I'm a psychotherapist. In this podcast series, I'll be chatting with different people about their experiences, their lives, their loves, their challenges, and what helps them find their way forward in the world. I'll also chat to different therapists and researchers about the models of therapy that they use to get a better understanding of these different approaches and how these different approaches might be useful at different times for different people. Hopefully it'll be lots of human connection and conversation about the challenges we have and also about what helps us get through. I hope it's going to be fun, enjoyable, entertaining, engaging, informative. Anyway, let's go on the journey. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Therapy Talks. So today we have a returning guest. I think it's nearly 3 years ago. It was end of January 2021 when I talked to Alan Cook. Alan is an Emmy Award-winning writer and a poet. And we talked at the time about his experiences of working with what he was doing in terms of his poetry and bringing it to the people, connecting with men in particular. And we talked a lot about the work he was doing then. And I suppose in recent months, Alan has gone through quite a profound, I guess, grief experience, if you want to call it that. And we had been chatting recently and I was saying, you know, we kind of thought maybe it might be good to come back onto the podcast and see where he's at. So, Alan, how are you doing?
Chris, thank you very much for having me on this previously stormy day. The sun has just come out. I think it's a nice metaphor. Mm. I was sitting there with the torrential wind and the elements, and I was like, oh, here we go. Here comes autumn and winter. And then the sun just came through. It was a beautiful moment. It just literally peeked through the clouds and took command of the day. And it might change again, just like Ireland does. But I'm doing okay, yeah. I'll cut straight into the purpose of the conversation, which is basically back in July, mid-July of this year, when we were sort of getting a rough, rainy summer, I was inhabiting my usual type of environment, which is a little cabin in the burn with my beloved cat. And the cat has obviously a pertinence to this statement. And just ticking along, making plans after I'd been working at this retreat center, which is where we had met, and trying to figure out what is my next step with this huge body of work I had. How am I going to get this out to people? And unfortunately then, for me personally, and we can talk about this more in length, but a little tragedy struck in my heart that I was going out to see a friend of mine and I left my cat at the back of the cabin. He hangs out in the back area there, which is quite safe. And then I drove out 10 minutes later and he was lying on the road. Yeah. It's actually not so hard to talk about now, but it's still quite tricky. And it was a lightning bolt moment through my heart. Basically what happened was it shunted me into a very, very hard place in myself. I call it the bell, let's just say. So much pain erupted in me in that moment. So much calamity and so much devastation or devasted from my normal sense of ordinariness that it shifted everything from here to there. After we had taken care of him, and thank God my friend was there in that moment to catch the worst part of that shock. And I went off and I meant to meet the friend I had meant to meet, and came back and everything had just altered in me. It was, I have to say, Chris, it was profoundly painful. Mm. Just to illuminate the listeners, I have had grief before. I've had my mother passed. I had a marriage loss. I had my best friend die. This was all quite one after the other, which just segues into what probably was happening here. And then I had my other cat die in my arms. And we all partake in these losses in different ways, but these happen cumulatively. But there's something about this particular grief that really triggered. It was like the straw. And so I started out, I packed some of my stuff. The cabin to me felt like a graveyard. And then I just took off across Ireland, and I had a little bit of means to be able to do that because of something project I just completed, and I had no real ties at the time and I still don't. So I took off doing the one thing I think that has altered and healed and distilled something in me, which is back into the landscape. And but this time it was very different. It was a flight of emergency and urgency, because I literally, I admit it here honestly, I could not cope with the loss. The loss was really an undoing, a shattering. So I stayed in Tipperary for a while, and then I went across down to the Alleghenies, and I'll explain more of the journey in detail. And I just went out into these landscapes, these beautiful, profound, deep, sonorous, resonant places. And I just surrendered myself, my grief and all of it, into Ireland's heart, into Ireland's soul. And yes, we do it in pockets. We go for walks in parks. We stand at the brow of an ocean if we have something that we're being in conflict with. But there was so much that was loaded in me that I literally couldn't stand still in the place that I'd left. That, for me, was a tragic moment. Someone said to me, well, why didn't you just stay where you're at? Because I said, I would not pitch a tent at my worst place of hurt. I needed to go out and try and find other places that were at once familiar in my connection with nature, but could language something in me that I couldn't find a coping mechanism for. And so that began this huge path that I'm still on to a degree. That's nearly 8,000 miles later. And people go, how do you drive 8,000 miles around Ireland? It's not that big. But in fact, there was many places, many journeys, many places of staying, much writing, much invitation, and a lot of camping in my car and being up in the mountains and the rivers. And so that's a brief overview without going into the details, which we can probably do now. But the catalyst.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those things, you know, with a, like, I mean, I've been through my own experience of grief,
yeah,
in terms of, you know, losing my dad. And then, you know, but I was thinking back as I was thinking about, you know, how we, I think losing a pet, a connection to an animal, but I think there was something I realized, and I think we had talked briefly over Facebook Messenger, and something about it that was seemed to me was that there was absolutely the grief of your cat, this being that you connect deeply, but it seemed to be opening a door, as you were saying, into possibly like a, it's almost like a kind of a volcano of grief emerges.
Yeah.
I don't know if
I
that,
think, yeah, it does. And I'll tell you why. Even in the, we go back to the ancient art of keening, and you hear this warbling cry of a community or a group of women that would actually transmute the loss. They would articulate the loss through this sound. And I made the same sound on reflection. I made the same sounds that I made when my marriage went, when I had a serious car accident, when I lost my mother, when I lost my best friend, and when my other cat passed away. So it was like a tagline of the same type of reaction. And then this one then seemed to me to be a peak moment of almost like it brought everything all up. And I thought, I think I had worked through a lot of this stuff, especially through nature and my physical work and my poetry and my talks. But obviously, as we know, the work is never done. And I'm grateful that I had the courage to decide to go forward into the energy of this path that was really, I was pushed into in a choiceless way, because I go, what makes you make these decisions? Right? Say I had children or a partner and I had to be where I was, and how would I have alchemized that? And I think the important part is when you're living with yourself and you say you have a creature or something in your life that you love more than yourself. So when that goes, that hole is probably a lot larger than if there was a family structure that you could all sort of collectively hold the grief. So that's something I thought a lot about. But beyond that, with personal calamities or griefs or traumas, sometimes nothing can hold that space, no matter how caring people are. And my only option in my soul instinct was to go out to Ireland, which sounds very dramatic, and but to me it has turned into something that started to unfold beyond those initial griefs. Once I'd gotten through the deeper, harder parts, and they were very, very difficult, it started to unfold into a sort of a wider arc, a wider ripple. And so much that has happened between personal encounters with people who had their own losses they shared with me, through the poems I left in different houses and places all over Ireland, to the amount of beautiful landscapes and sunsets and mythical creatures that inhabit this island that came at appropriate times when I didn't have any wind in my sails. So a lot of the time when I was going, questioning myself, questioning my sanity, something would occur that would just give me a little bit of wind to go, no, keep going in this path. And I think the energy that I have in this journey right now is already profoundly changed me. And maybe it's cleared something out. Maybe it's made a huge growth spurt. Maybe it's things I couldn't encounter singularly, but now I had no choice. And I call it this sort of choiceless destiny, or in the Buddhist Zen, they call it no way is the way. And I've had to find myself through some very, very difficult moments, both circumstantially and also internally at the same time. And I've had to get very good at making decisions, and also looking for where the invitation was in life itself to move me to the next part. And it's very arbitrary, very strange, probably a bit out there the way I'm talking, but I got into this rhythm of trusting my instincts and trusting my relationship with Ireland. And we don't do that a lot, because most of us have pretty densely structured lives, and we can't deviate much from them. We might have pockets of where we're getting time to look outside ourselves. Now, in my position, in my artist life, whatever you want to call it, I guess I have more spaces in those time frames, which can be good and bad, because when you're in these places and you say you're some of the days I had weren't filled the way I wanted it, that can be very heavy. But then that's also where I had the most profound encounters with myself, and that is hard medicine, and that takes a lot of courage. And I'm not kind of awarding myself anything here, because you realize then that those experiences are trying to show you something. They're trying to just bring you home to some part of yourself that you might have been. I ran toward in nature, but I was probably running away from up to that point. So there's a contradiction.
So you were both running to something that you had been running away from?
Exactly. And I know it sounds like a duality, but being the way I was living, not very away from the world life, where I had a lot of these gifts and skills that weren't being fully utilized, removing the cat from the equation opened up the floodgates of what I call this unlimited choices. And going into the landscape, I started to get a reflection of that. Eventually, that bigger part of myself, the part that is, we all have inside us, this enormous life energy, this powerful inner, I would call it psychological and Celtic mythological potential, which we see reflected in our culture, in our music, in our history. So I had that partly embodied in myself, but it was sort of cut off. So when he left in that little bubble of love that I shared, then I was shot out of the nest into the world, into another newer initiation, which you think only happens when you're young, but they happen throughout your life. And as my friend Patrick said, who's a poet and philosopher, sometimes you have to spend time regenerating your heart, and it happens. It can happen over cycles. But these aren't in the modern world, these ideas. But what I did learn is that Ireland is a very, very powerful teacher, and a very hard teacher, but a very beautiful mentor. If you can trust, truly trust, to keep engaging with the landscape. And as I was lucky enough to have a length of time to do it fully, which is both frightening and inspiring, I got so much. It's like you're running a marathon, and I get all these people giving me bottles of water on the way. I got so much encouragement. I got so many of my male friends going, God, I wish I could do that. I got so many people, like, for example, I was going to get this camping bed in Tralee. I went into the store, and there was a young girl there about 19 and an older woman there about 40. And they would be very trying to find me this pump for the bed. And I was a bit like, oh, where's the pump? And oh, we'll get you one. It's okay. And just segued into the conversation about why you're traveling, and told them what I was doing, and told them I was starting to write about grief and thinking of writing a book. And the one woman turned around and whispered to me, well, my partner took his life 6 years ago. And it shook me and it threw me back. And then the other girl, who was a traveler from the traveling community, she had no family. They were all gone. Aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, all gone, Chris. They're all because of addiction stuff. One a week she was losing at one point. One a week. It was like concentration camp levels. And this is not to equate that with it, but for her to lose everybody, how do you stand that? And she was standing there to me like a rock. And I was so humbled. I was so taken aback. I was so struck. And they turned around and said to me, will you keep going anyway for us? And that gave me the wind in my sails to go to another part of this chapter. So this happened a lot. I would go, I'm turning back. What am I doing here? Like, you know, and then I get some encounter. Like, I had a friend of mine, I won't mention names, who I'd met in the Buddhist temple in the Dojambara in where I was spending a lot of time down in that part of the world. And we meditated together, and then we did realize it wasn't doing much. We stood out on the balcony and we talked and became sort of friends. And he was hitching at the time because he doesn't like cars. And I drove him over the mountains in a place called Eyries, which is near Ollie. It's a beautiful place. And we just connected, and he said, "Look, come down at some point if you want to Dingle and spend a bit of time writing there." So, beautiful summer's day, drove up to Dingle, spent time in his house, and he had a severe losses. He had a daughter who'd passed away very young, 15, and then he'd had a brother, lost his brother, and a couple of things. But I was just admiring of his capacity to invent the day, his capacity to withstand those storms, and his capacity to hold a beautiful space for others who are suffering. So this is what had grown out of his shoot of loss. But we had a very unusual moment, and this is part of what of my purpose in this journey. He turned around and said to me at the very late hour when we had rolled out into the darkness and had a conversation about losses. He said, "Would you write a poem?" And I do this for a lot of people who write poems. "Will you write a poem to my brother who's passed away?" I said, "Sure, I will." Then he said, "Would you also write a poem to my daughter who isn't really speaking to me?" And he said, "Of course." I said, "I will." And then the last poem he asked me to write, which was, I've never been asked anything like this in my life, is, "Would you write a poem? Would you write a poem for my daughter who's passed away as if she was speaking to her sister?"
As if she was speaking to her sister. Lord.
So I went upstairs with the storms banging on the window. It was a strange, stormy night on a summer's evening. And I wrote the three poems. This stuff comes out of me fairly quick once I get a sense of what I have to do. And I went back downstairs, and we spent the rest of the time sitting in our boxers talking, and I read the poems to him. And he was very, very moved. And that, you see, it was another root growing out of what was happening in my journey. So he gave me, that happened a lot. I did a concert in Kells in a very big estate for quite a wealthy man, and this is at the beginning of all this journey. And the woman who was handing him over the house was a beautiful woman of 93 years old, and she told me a story the next day of how her son had gone out to tend the sheep and he never came back. So people kept sharing their stories. I became like some kind of canvas for loss sharing, and I wasn't going around telling everyone what was happening. It was just, and I wasn't like, these are really huge tragedies, not like, not to diminish what happened to me, but looking in terms of the scale of looking at these human losses, there, these were way deeper. Like, so, and that occurred time and time again. So every time I thought, like, this is a senseless reaction to my cat's passing, because of my ability to write and to expose and articulate these things in words, I was being given these little tasks on the path, whether it be in Kells or up in the Cork and Kerry Mountains or the Owlaheys or Dingle Peninsula or up in Donegal or in Connemara. Like, I zigzag. If you looked at my line, if you drew a little pencil drawing of my journey in Ireland, it would just be a scribbly mess
You've literally gone all over the country,
all over, most of it, not everywhere,
a
but
lot
I
of
spent,
it.
yeah, a good deal of time down in the Bear Peninsula, which I'm sure some people know quite well. I was profoundly struck in my initial stages of this calamity how deep the land was able to hold my worst pain. I found something in that, the end of the edge of the world. It had the darkest of dark, but the lightest of light. So if I was feeling some kind of darkness, it somehow would like a draw it out of me and hold it. And then if I was feeling anyway more towards in a good place in myself, if it was a sunny day, it would be the most profoundly heavenly, beautiful light that would hold me in the other sense. So it's like a pendulum, you know. And I camped there a good for a good couple of weeks, and I went all over the mountains and the rocks there. And in the early stages, I would be swimming. The swimming is a great place to wash your grief in a way. And again, I would have conversations with people standing in the water, and so there was always threads. I really see it very strongly that there's threads pulling me to the next footsteps, to the next path. And this is not for the faint-hearted, because you're going, well, what's going to happen next? So
You were kind of taking steps into the unknown every day. You didn't have a destination. You were just
no,
in the journey. Like, it
yeah,
was like utterly, I'm not driving anywhere. I'm on the journey.
Yeah. And that would fill me with the most, the biggest doubts you can even possibly. And that was also part of me trying to heal, which is like John Moriarty, the philosopher, said when he went out walking one day and he just had a breakup of one of his relationships, and he walked out into the night and he said he was really stricken with grief. And he found a barn to sleep in. And the farmer came in and seemed the next day. He says, "Oh, I'm sorry." He says, "Oh, it's okay. You can sleep in the barn." He said, "Can I help you?" He said. And he said, "Oh, can you cut turf?" So he cut turf all day. So they both were looked after by the moment. And that's another part I'll tell you about in a second. So he said, "If I empty out my pockets, if I empty out my heart, if I empty out my mind, if I empty out my spirit, will the universe still take care of me?" And this is the big one. This is the big one that probably frightens half of society. If everything's taken away, if you can't land anywhere except with yourself, could you be there with yourself in that moment? And that's probably, for myself included, truly terrifying, because then you have this thing called freedom of choice. Choice and freedom, as much as people go on about how important freedom is, really most people are scared of it.
It's what the existentialists would say is the biggest fear, is the biggest issues for us all is freedom, choice, and death. Our own death, or facing our mortality, freedom, and having choice, and that once we can come to terms with those, we have a great, so it's kind of everything you're saying, that you're kind of talking about things to me that on the one hand I'm hearing it in terms of a therapeutic lens of like the a deep healing journey that you've been on, and where you're both on the one hand, like there's something about it, like you describe it running from and running to, you're in nature trying to, you've been lost and been found all at the same time.
Yeah.
Held within that space. And you said something there that John Moriarty talks about, that idea of when there's nothing left, can I be with myself?
Yeah.
Can I dare? It's like being ultimately held by myself.
And it's like a form of a rebirth, because a true rebirth is when that old skin, and I think reflecting back now, I walked out of it very old skin that day. And when I had to go back and sort through some stuff there, it felt like a graveyard. Not just the cat's passing, because I felt the cat had moved on, he was gone, whatever your beliefs are about that. It was like I came back to an old life that was long gone. Now that's like, well, that's great. But you're like, okay, now what am I going to do? So you've got a blank canvas, no matter what your circumstances are. Is my friend said to me something quite profound. He said, "Well, you're in Ireland now, but you're in a new country." And I was like, "Yeah, exactly."
Ireland isn't a big country, and yet you're describing it in terms of going into the depths of the land, the depths of your own psyche within that open space, that it makes it kind of massive.
It's the street became terrifying. I would go, because there's a whole theme around what home was to me. And I go, I had a lot of discussions with people about home, and people say it's their kids. People say it's their work. People say it's their brick and mortar. They turn the key in. And then some people say it's the skin in your body. It's your soul. It's whatever you, it's what you embody, wherever you stand. And so I went to, and still going through, a huge idea of what that is. And the beauty of, I think I can say this, the beauty of where I'd been many times was I found home in the face of strangers. I found connectivity, human connectivity, to be a form of home. And I don't know whether that's an obvious thing to say, but on reflecting back, the what regrounded me was conversation. What regrounded me was encountering what is meant to be a stranger, which is a foreign soul, but actually was utterly one of us. And no connections to family or no history. And I would say to people sometimes, like, when we walk the other way, we're both walking off into eternity. We'll probably never see each other again. Yeah. And there was a sort of what I'd call a beautiful sadness to that. But that's what made the exchange have memory, have meaning. And I've had so many conversations where we did like a cross meeting on the bridge and exchanging stories. It doesn't matter what the topic was, but there was something very resonant because you knew you were moving past them.
Mm.
So, and that was, I mean, I have too many stories. It'd take a few hours to tell. Hopefully, I'll tell it if I'm writing this book about all this, hopefully.
Mm.
I had in the Alaheys, first for a beautiful example, I remember camping, doing my car camping and opening up the door and just being assaulted by shooting stars all over the Milky Way. There was like loads of them, one after the other. I just had cooked a dinner on my stove outside. And I was like, what a gift. And every time something profound happened, I go, Jesus, I wouldn't be here because of my cat. He's actually after segueing me into all these different portals of adventure, of despair, of grief. The whole package was unleashed because of his passing. It was a turned a key. Instead of opening a dam, it turned a key to a door, and then another door, and then another door, because our lives are full of infinite possibilities. But we get onto certain paths because of a decision, because of something in the news, and we don't realize how flexible and altering our life can be. John Moriarty said sometimes we have to walk backwards across China, you know, just to remind ourselves of our humanness. And I think as difficult as this has been, and I'm not throwing any romance over this at all, I think the theme for me personally is remembering who I am. And I wanted to go back to something I was talking about, is I did a lot of work for people across Ireland because I'm quite skillful from being in the retreat centre. I can chop wood, I can build things, I can paint, and besides my creativity. And I paid and unpaid, I started I'm laughing because I felt like I was that guy in Kung Fu, the old TV series. I was wandering the earth, my black car. I was like a stranger, like Johnny Cash, a stranger in a strange town. Suddenly I'd put a flyer up and someone would call me, can you do this? And everybody I went to was in some form of crisis with their particular project. And I came in and I'm not like some superhero. And I go, right, I'd get it done in 3 days or 2 days or 4 days. And we'd have this great exchange. And then I drive off. The contract would end. I was like, oh my God, this is so surreal. You know what I put it akin to? I often think of the salmon trying to leap up into the river. I love, this is one of my favorite, you know, the salmon knowledge. I go, right, salmon spends his whole life up the river, up on top of these plateaus. How does he get up there? He never gives up. 2,800 kilometers or something like that. And then he mates and he dies when he gets there. But there are rivulets inside the rivers that go the opposite direction. So he finds those little, and that's where I'd been living. I'd been living in these rivers of possibility going upstream in a very difficult situation. So I used to think about that a lot and think about the idea of no way is the way. And what does that mean? I was recently in the Cumra Mountains in Tipperary, near where my friend, I'm staying with a friend of mine, and a beautiful place. If everyone ever should go up there, it's Mahon Falls. And it's this incredible bowl, cliff, valley landscape of rough-hewn rock and moss and more beauty, incredible beauty from Ireland. And it was like I'd gotten full circle. I'd been in Tipperary at the beginning and now I'm at Tipperary after 10 weeks and I'd changed utterly. And I stood there outside my car. It was a beautiful evening and going, Jesus, I think I've come to the end of this chapter. And I walked down to the falls. It's about a 25-minute walk along this little path. I got to the waterfalls, the famous waterfalls, and I was like, I get it. It suddenly dropped in me. I get it. The waterfall spends thousands of years finding its way through impossible rock. I was like, what makes it beautiful? Why do we love waterfalls? You know, the beautiful, the almost romantic notion of a waterfall. It's because of the path that it's carved. The shape of it creates its own beauty. I was like, you know what? This is where I've been. This is me. I've been trying to find my way through these rocks of my psyche, of my path, of my life, of my soul path. And I feel like I've grown extensively in a very kind of short period of time. And I haven't even processed 90% of this stuff. So I was like, that's what I found. I was finding a way where there was no way. And because I was having to live each day as a collection of decisions, that the decisions weren't made already for me, that's hardcore growth because you have to trust you. And if you've had any doubts or fears or traumas or anxieties, which we all do, you had to go through that. You had to, as Alan Watts says, not row, put up a sail and trust that you were going to find your way through whatever particular storm in that day it is. So I think we've become increasingly reliant on the structure of the world to comfortably strap ourselves in and let it take us through the day. When that's ripped off, like grief does to you.
Absolutely. Grief shuts it up. Grief strips everything bare.
So that's some of the findings I've made, and I'm sure the practical logicians listening would go, yeah, but how does it survive? What's it going to do? Where's it going to go? And these are all perfectly rational questions, and I have found ways, you know. I'm like, what's the ultimate destination? That I can't answer. But I know when something new happens, when a renewal happens, when, for want of a better word, without getting too dramatic, a sort of a resurrection happens out of being stripped to the bone,
Transformation.
you're not given the luxury of the destination, because that's because the journey is part of that. If you were to know exactly, oh, you're going to be in this place here in 2 weeks' time, talk to John here, and that's that, we wouldn't be in the same frame of mind or discovery. So this harks back to any journey, whether it's people who like have a child to go on the journey of pregnancy, they're in that journey of the unknown, right, for 9 months, which you'd gone through, or they're crossing a desert, they're doing some big, you know, explore thing, or they lose somebody, like my friend has a very good friend who was married for 70 years and his wife just passed away. What kind of journey is ahead for him? So I guess what I'm saying is, I think it's relatable to many people listening about the idea of being in the unknown, and the courage it can takes for all of us. And but the beauty of being held in that space, if you can trust it, you know.
There's a what is a unifying story, isn't it? It unites us
Yes,
all in a way, because none of us can
exactly.
escape the ravages of grief and loss. None of
Nope.
us can,
No.
as it, nobody gets out of here alive. You know, like
Yes.
there is only one destination in that sense, but
Yeah.
there's something about the way we approach it, like the way you've trusted something deeper. You know, it's like a handing over to in some way, and allowing that, you know, in a sense, as you describe the waterfall, and the journey of the waterfall to get to this majestic place was, you know, it was through rock and resistance and fight and grit and yet and acceptance. And there's something in this, like
Yeah.
you're talking about something deeply accepting as well in the process.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It is the hardest space I've ever walked through in my life. And I've had some blows, like we all have. And I've chopped wood, and I've done all this thing about the al and I do believe in the alchemy that nature provides. But this one was like, yes, the landscape was there for me, but I had so many moments of being absolutely in free fall, of being utterly ungrounded, and I'd come back to the sea, or I'd come back to the mountains, and somewhere there was always like, there's one place I went. It's in, I think it's called Lorig. It's between, Kenmare and the Alleghis, and it's a space of like really dense lakes and ocean banks and trees, and there's something very serene and very different to the other place I'd been in. And I would camp there, and I just found this little pocket, this little tiny little bay with a couple of old boats, and this beautiful mountain in the background. It looks like something from Japan, with a little puff of cloud around the peak. And it was the first time since all of this pain had begun that I went, it's somehow just, I would say it's a place that was empty but still filled with the presence of everything. And I could just sit there, and actually everything I felt in my life, I could just put it out there, and it just held us like almost in a bubble of time. And that was an absolutely huge moment for me. It's like, wow, I was right. The land really can hold your worst places and not let you sink, or not let you, it's like it takes it. So let me lift this from you for a while. And I went back to that place a lot when I was there. And I would sit in the back of my car, and I'd write, there's a talk I wrote, which I hope to do for people, called The Possibilities of Grief, The Unwanted Gift, about all of these different, and that allowed me to finish that talk there. And I was in a pretty bad place while I was writing this. I wrote it very raw in a way, and probably the best time to do it. But between that and the fires I would light, and then these landscapes, they became not places to visit and enjoy. They became key holding places to hold me in the most despairing hour, when there was nobody around. There was nobody around. I had friends on the phone and stuff, but there was, in my physical presence, when I had such physical longing for what I'd lost, there was nobody around in those moments. And to feel a sense of inner sovereignty and calm when I should have felt all the opposite things, that was due, in fact, to the landscape, to our, to that topography in Ireland. is, I think, also relates to our human geography, our human, our inside geography. And if you unlock the if you find the key relational places with you and the place, they sort of fuse together in a way, I
like
think.
An alchemy or something, is it?
Yeah, they fuse together, I feel. Yeah. And I felt that. I'm speaking from the heart when I say this. I really mean this. I felt that so much. I felt that so much. And what didn't require ceremony or doing some kind of weird ancient practice, right? It was just me standing there, and suddenly something would occur, and I'm gone. And I think because I was becoming more sensitive to the different places I was finding myself in, and that's where the thread I pulled was. I would find myself being drawn to a certain area or a certain county or a certain, someone would tell me something, oh, would you not think of going up there? And suddenly you'd find yourself in this extraordinary landscape, and you're like, that wasn't a coincidence. You know, there was a lot of, I know there's a whole discussion about sync. There was a massive amount of human and geographical synchronicity.
Yeah, I was thinking when you're describing it, like on the one hand, there's that sense of physical aloneness, and then suddenly finding this connection with the landscape that holds that space. And then there's these chance conversations and these people, these random moments where you meet people, and then connections and friends, and all of this stuff is happening that's supporting you or witnessing you or something, or being, you know, but it's like there's, you were not alone, and yet you were fundamentally alone.
Yeah, I guess it's like, again, I won't get religious because I know we'll call it God. You can call it the force, or you can call it Buddha, or you can call it the great thing. I don't know. We'll just say God. I heard a saying recently that said, if your journey is important, life will say, life, God will always hold you in its hands. And I had another meeting where I was going whale watching in Bantry. And I met these two women sitting on the bank of the shore, and we got into this conversation. Someone had just, someone who passed away again. And he said, how's the journey been? I said, actually, it's been quite difficult. I said, well, she said, if it's difficult, then it must be important. And I thought, bingo. See, there's another, like, I didn't go, oh, I'm away with the fairies now, and that makes me, I can keep being away with the fairies. I thought, okay, there's another little kernel of wisdom, almost like something was speaking through somebody else to go, you see, you're not, it's not a waste of life. It's not a fruitless wander. You're getting.
We have to listen more.
Exactly. Exactly. And that is one of the big ones as well, Chris, is like to truly be present. I mean, really be there, not with the future, the fear of tomorrow or the regret of the past or things, you know, that has to be done. If you can truly be there. It's like that quote from Kafka, and I'll paraphrase it. You don't have to leave the room. You don't even have to move out of your chair. If you sit still long enough, the world will unroll in ecstasy at your feet.
Wow.
And I think that's where I've been. I know it's getting later in the day now. Can I just finish this? I know we can have another whole. I want to finish this with the poem that I initially wrote the second day this happened. And I think it's for anybody out there who's sitting in that darkness. I hope, even though this poem is quite somber, I hope there's something in here to give you the kernel of a seed to look past your initial grief and see that there's other seeds growing out of that.
Yeah, it'd be
so amazing. it's called Oh Grief. Oh grief, your tremulous tones over the black sea of my bones, your efficient hands making new deep scars, and your forgiven servant of nature, the mountain pass of loss blocks the way home now. The devastation has light as a feather, with perfection your ending of beauty, leaving only endless torments of ghosts, where stark reality, your ally, clasps its rune upon my gentle soul. O grief, the dance you play on all our fears, the human calamity, the lightning strike of loss, the searing wordless storm that cuts the reason from my being, and then we are left with salt and water from the eyes, with endless nights of relentless torments, with memories that invert into shadows, ghoulish imprints that wrap thorns around the innocence of love. Oh grief, what seed did you plant in my name? What torrid wisdom did you make in me as you sacrifice all I adore? Oh grief, so timeless, and that now I am without a name, without a path. I stand in your pitch black river, neck deep in my own betrayal, because I loved, you came, because I cared, you came, because I had tenderness, you came. You steal my home, the shelter of my promise, and I have no more words for you. And I'm somehow crucified in your mystery, and all I can do is strap myself to the masts of the ship of time and hold on and wait until I see a spark, a seed, an ember of meaning. And all the world waits with me. And even though in that impossible hour, I hope it may never come again.
Well, I have that idea of strapping in and waiting for the ember, the spark.
It's funny, isn't it? Because that's the one line I love out of all this. When we're in the midst of the deepest losses, all we can do is strap ourselves to that mast of the ship of time and let it. And that's what's happened. My grief is lessened now. It's still there and it never really goes. It's just life grows around it like a scar, you know? And all I know is that and I haven't even gone into all the other writing I'm doing, but all the work to come for me, if I can make it through this last part of it, is for me to get to the audience, to get to the people, to stand in front of people and share the story. I was down one more story here before I go in Mill Street there with a few people I might be doing a bit of work with, and they were beautiful, simple, humble people. And I sat for 2 hours because they wanted to hear my story, and they were enraptured, not because I was waxing lyrical, but because it was tapping into all of their wells, all of their secret places, all of their sacred holdings that I had just burst out of from this path. So there is meaning and purpose, I hope, to where I've been walking, you know.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you again. I mean, a pleasure may be the wrong word, but it seems quite, but you know, there's something to hear you talk about it. It's sort of, I mean, I've taken a lot of from it for myself, but there's something about there's trust, isn't there? There's like a deep, you have to trust something.
Yeah, it's at the Chris. You're hitting the kernel of all of this. I've had so many conversations. I have a couple of people who I call every day for support, and one of them is a friend of mine who's a very respected psychotherapist, and he's been walking with me in a way. And I do come back to this thing all the time. When I say it's like serving, it's like walking on a tightrope but serving pints. Like you can fall off. I'll give you one more little tiny parable about a Bible story about, you know, Christ walking across the water, you know, on the water. And I always see he's walking through the storm-filled ocean, and the apostles are going, geez, I'm not going out there, like, you know. And St. Peter says, I'll go, and he steps out and he starts walking across the water, and then he puts his head down and he starts sinking. And then Christ reaches his hands up out of the water and he's like nearly drowned. He says, I told you I would take care of you. And he said, why did I fall? He said, because you took your eyes off me, but I'll never take my eyes off you.
No.
And for me right now, lying here, sitting here in this house, that's where I'm at right now. I have to trust that this has a purpose. And when I speak, this is why I wanted to do this interview with you. I wanted to speak out some of these places in me that are requiring me to story what's coming out of my pores right now. And it just gives me a little sense more of I sort of get a very faint hint of the destination. And the destination is not a place. It's a place within myself to share with others who, as we know, the world is in big grief right now. And we could have a lot of conversation about all of these tendrils. And I just hope that, as John Moriarty said, sometimes a little parable is acted out upon you. Whatever's been acted out upon me with my gifts that I have, it's to set off that path in the end, ultimately, for others. And I truly say in my heart, I'm doing this also ultimately for other people as well. You know, in service in a way.
So yeah. And I suppose it's that thing of if we can, you know, embody that service and we continue to serve, it seems to be, but it seems to be you're having to listen very deeply to yourself and trust and move and value. I was at a training on Saturday and he said, have authority in yourself. Have an authority for what you do. Have a belief, like that sense of embodiment. And there's something you talk about, your gifts and your writings and your sense that you need to bring us to people. There requires in that a sense of like you're having to trust that this is your path and
exactly.
that this is your path and value what, you know, like it's profound. And at the same time, you're constantly amidst nature, like holding you in that space. You know, so it's like it hasn't ended. Your journey is beginning.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And to end it like the pressures of the world. People don't realize what the pressures of the ordinary world are until they step out of it. You know when you get a flat tire on a motorway or you have to stop on the layway and you realize how fast the cars are going. So think about that. If you're driving, you go, listen to a podcast, a bit of music, until you stop in the car and you go, oh my God. That's what it feels like for me at times. That the ordinary world feels terrifying to me because it's rolling. And you're there trying to almost like create this new part of yourself in a garden within yourself, and you're trying to deal with the world at the same time, which doesn't understand, you know.
There's something to finish, and I'm conscious because I was thinking of something you said at the start about like your life before, in a sense, you maybe retreated, in a way, and you were in Bog Hill and living in that life, in service and learning an awful lot, but there was a retreat, and then there's this grief, there's this loss, this terror, and you're thrust out of there's a quote. Can I read it to you actually?
Yeah, please do.
I was at a training and it's a quote by Winnicott, and it just really reminds me of what you've just said in a way. And he says, "It's a pleasure to hide, but a tragedy not to be found."
Oh my God, that's beautiful. So that also made me cry, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I've done is live that. I actually feel getting upset just thinking about that. I've given myself in all sorts of different ways, whether it's leaving poems or kindness or service or help. I've given myself, and I've almost asked myself to be found by others, to share my humanity with them. And it is a pleasure to hide, trust me. But it's also a much more profound richness to share yourself with the world, as much as we all are very tired of the way the world is right now.
Well, we might be tired of a version of the world, and it doesn't have to be
exactly
the version. You know, we can create different versions, and there's something about, you know, so that we can, the pleasure to hide and retreat, but the journey you've been on is anything, in the last 8 weeks you describe it as nothing but hiding. It's actually having to come out of the hiding into the pain of loss and darkness and come out through that to something else. And then it's about stepping forward, isn't it? And saying, I have to join the ordinary world in one way.
Yes.
But in a different way. It's not like I'm going to go back and, you know, do whatever, but I have to go into the world now.
Yeah.
I have to take this.
And I think in the end, Chris, when you're reflecting back so acutely, it also makes you feel like that it hasn't been just a reaction to grief. It has been started as that, but then became something that's revealed itself within that seed, if that makes sense.
And you see, I think that's the piece that requires trust. When we're caught up in grief's cloak, as you describe it so well, of grief, it is a dark cloak. And for some people, for some of us, that's what we don't get beyond that. We get stuck within the darkness.
Exactly.
You know, and the tragedy, in a sense, is not recognizing that within that dark cloak, this huge possibility of there's an ember of light.
Exactly.
There's an ember and spark, and you've lit the spark, and there's a flame that's taking hold now, and it feels that flame. It, you know, it's like all of these conversations can keep that spark burning, can keep the flame.
Absolutely.
You know,
and I think that's the kernel of the book I'm going to try and write about this journey, but also the talk I did, I have to edit. And it's my belief that grief in the world is actually the thing that's going to bring us, unite us against, aside from religion, war, creed, color, race, money, politics, all the ideology stuff that people are arguing about, is the one thing that we can all absolutely commonly find a complete commonality in, is the fact that we all suffer loss.
Yeah.
And that bond, when we share that and articulate it, like, what's his name? The singer, Nick Drake, when he lost his son. Yeah, he said,
Nick Cave.
Yeah. He has to, one has to articulate his grief. And I call it exhuming the grief out of the body. Because if we don't exhume it, it becomes like a monster that can eat us, you know, or it could stay sedated and actually not find somewhere there's the beauty ultimately in that. And the beauty is actually in finding, using the grief in communion with others, and not just at a funeral. I always say the last act of love from a person who's died is to leave unconditional love in the room at the funeral. But it goes beyond that. It goes actually way beyond that. There's a ripple effect. And everything that has happened since my cat has passed, I've touched on loads of different lives that I'd never met before. I've had profound friendships occur through this. So that's valuable. That's life changing. That's life reflecting. That's life altering. So if we can all share that bigger community, what are the possibilities from a global context? And I think we're heading towards that. My instinct feeling is that we're heading towards a final recognition of a global grief beyond all the different particular calamities. And if we can have these kind of conversations on a global level, I find them much more valuable than just people dividing each other all the time, you know?
It's a lovely way to finish. It's a hopeful way to finish.
It is.
Alan, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great.
So look, I will talk to you again, hopefully at some point in the future. To everyone else, I don't know what the word is, but I hope you've got from, certainly got from this conversation what I've got in some way. And I will talk to you all next time. Alan, thank you so much for being a guest once again.
Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. No problemo.
Bye, everyone. Talk to you
See
next
you.
Time. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.